Kendall. The producer was Caroline Dunn. Before that, The Forum, a world of ideas from the BBC World Service, presented by Bridget Kendall.
How many languages do you speak? And how many are you fluent in? If you're like me, you're only really fluent in your mother tongue, even if you can get by in a couple of other languages and order coffee or an ice cream in a few more. But lots of people are multilingual, truly fluent in two or more languages, and it's their experience we want to explore today. What are the advantages and disadvantages? What's the impact of speaking one language at home and another one at school? And how is the brain affected by juggling between different languages? Joining me today to discuss this are bilingual poet, writer, and professor of Latin American and Iberian cultures at Columbia University in the United States, Gustavo Perez Fermat, Antonella Sorace, professor of developmental linguistics at Edinburgh University in Scotland and director of the information network Bilingualism Matters, and cognitive neuropsychologist, Professor Ellen Bialystok from York University in Toronto, Canada, whose pioneering research tracks the impact of bilingualism on the brain. Welcome to all of you, and can I start by asking each of you to briefly sum up for me, why does being able to speak more than one language interest you? Gustavo, what about you?
What I'm interested in is a bilingual's affective relationship with his languages, what I call tongue ties, the quality and intensity of your attachment to your different languages. And so, for example, I am roughly equally fluent in Spanish and English, and yet I feel about the two languages very differently. I have the sense that my Spanish is much sadder than my English. My English is happier than my Spanish. So these two languages tie me in different ways.
That's fascinating. What about you, Antonella?
Well, languages have always played an important role in my life. I'm a linguist by training, and in my research I work on learning languages at all ages. I'm also a native speaker of Italian. I started learning English as a teenager, and I've been living in Scotland for 28 years. And I'm also the mother of bilingual children, so I know what it means to raise bilingual children.
We'll hear a bit more about that in a minute. Ellen, what about you?
Language is one of the most powerful experiences we have. And what we know now is that this experience of using two languages forces your brain into a somewhat different configuration than a mind that's configured to handle one language. And studying the effects of these two languages on the brain tells us a lot about how the brain works in general and what the mind is capable of doing.
We'll be hearing more about that too in a minute, which would be fascinating. But let's start with the personal and a bit more about your private experience, Gustavo. Your first language, as you said, was Spanish. You were born and lived in Havana, Cuba, till you were 11 years old. And then your family moved to Miami in the United States. So how long did it take you to feel that you had both languages equally?
I'm still trying to feel that I have both languages equally. Years ago in Miami, somebody coined the term nilingüe. In Spanish, the word for bilingual is bilingüe. And then a nilingüe is somebody who doesn't speak either language well. Ni español, ni inglés. And even though from sort of a technical point of view, I suppose I handle both languages fairly well, I have the sensation that I'm not at home entirely in either language.
Do you feel that you're a different person when you speak each language?
Yes, because I mentioned before that for me, you know, my English is happier than my Spanish. Spanish for me is a language of loss. It's a language of what could have been. It's a language of my parents. It's a language of the country I was born in.
This is the language of an exile from Cuba.
That's right. And so for me, Spanish is more than a maternal tongue, it's a paternal tongue. Because when I think of Spanish, I hear the voice of my father. English is a language of now, the language of the future. For me, it's a conjugal tongue. It's a language I share with my wife. It's a filial tongue. It's a language with which I speak with my children. And so, as a Spanish speaker, I'm a son. As an English speaker, I'm a husband and a father.
And you have this distinction that you make as a writer between having a language and having a tongue. What do you mean by that?
Yes, because for me, and this is a distinction simply based on the point of view of a writer, not of a student of the subject. For me, a language is an instrument, it's an implement, it's something that you make use of, it's something that exists outside of me. But a tongue is part of my body. You know, I can hold my tongue, I can bite my tongue, I cannot hold or bite my language. Other people can share my language, but nobody can share my tongue. And to some extent, you know, having been born in Cuba, living in the United States, these are enemy tongues, mm-hmm. or tongues that represent countries that have been at odds with each other mm-hmm. for most of my lifetime. And I think that also plays into one's tongue ties.
I keep thinking about, it's very philosophical, but I keep thinking about how much is this coloured by your experience of bilingualism being the experience of an exile, which is inevitably an experience of loss. And I wondered, Antonella, you've got another experience of bilingualism. How much do you relate to what you're hearing from Gustavo?
I partly, but only partly, relate to this. I understand the different emotions and sometimes also the feeling of displacement or belonging, you know, only to one language. But I think there is another side to that, a positive side, which is a bilingual person can be very adaptable, can, you know, mix much more easily, can adjust more easily, partly because they have familiarity with two languages and two cultures.
I think there's another perspective on this really important, intriguing issue, and that is the flip side of what Gustavo is talking about is a kind of parochialism that locks you in to a place and a language and a sensibility.
Well, you know, as an exile, perhaps you understand, well, I would be all in favor of parochialism, all in favor of one person, one country, and one language. There's a Czech proverb that says, learn a new language, get a new soul.
Yeah.
For me, I'm not sure it's always an advantage to have more than one soul.
I was thinking about this question of, you know, options or loss. And if you take away the exile experience, Gustavo, and just think about it in linguistic terms, do you find it easier to say some things in one language than another? Do you find yourself thinking, oh, you know, English isn't very adequate in this way? Spanish would say it so much better.
No. Sometimes what I feel is that the words fail me in both languages, that I can't think of them in either language. But no, certainly, yes. As I perceive it, there are all kinds of differences between Spanish and English. For example, take the English phrase, the facts of life. For American and English speakers, the facts of life are the facts of life. How do we say that in Spanish? Los misterios de la vida, the mysteries of life. There's a whole different worldview between viewing the facts of life as facts and viewing them as mysteries, as puzzles, as conundrums. And then the last thing is that one can translate the meaning of words, but one cannot translate the sound of words. And that's the sort of phonic substance of a language is really the most untranslatable part of a language. You know, it's music, it's melody.
You're a writer and a poet. Do you think you would be a better writer if you only spoke one language?
Well, maybe I would be just as lousy a writer, but I would inflict my lousy writing on only one group of people.
Oh, that's just false modesty.
But yes, because I would not feel what I constantly feel. I feel the choice of languages as a burden. I agree with Ellen and Antonella that it's a blessing in many ways, but when you're sitting in front of a paper and you're trying to decide in which language can I write, and you decide to write in one language, then you write one sentence, the next sentence occurs to you in a different language. And you want to be able to sort of speak both languages at once, because you think that only by doing that will you speak for all of yourself.
I can see Antonella shaking your head.
I'm shaking here from far away as well.
No, can I just say, I wonder to what extent, you know, this feeling of neolingualism, I think that's the word you used, is due to the fact that somehow we think that being bilingual means being the sum of two monolinguals. It's something different. It's much more. So you can't be perfect in both languages. And in fact, the perfect bilingual doesn't exist, in the sense that a bilingual who can use both languages in exactly the same ways, you know, to the same level of fluency.
Of course, Ellen, I was just going to say before you came in, it doesn't just have to be bilingual. Quite a lot of people are not just bilingual, they're multilingual. They have not just two languages, they have many languages. Ellen, why were you shaking your head?
I want to speak for the monolingual writer. And the experience that Gustavo is describing, I think, is The reason that we hold writers in high esteem, because the challenge of using language to express exactly what you mean is incredibly difficult in any language, including in a single language. So it's this search for the absolute best reflection of something that is essentially intangible that makes writing so hard. And you have that experience no matter how many pools of language you have to draw from.
Can I just say, if you are bilingual and you speak to other bilinguals, you can combine the richness of both languages and you can switch the other language to get the more juste from the other language.
You both have to speak both languages, don't you? But let's stay with you, Antonella Seracci, and talk a bit more about your work. You're Professor of Developmental Linguistics at Edinburgh University in Scotland and Director of the Information Centre Bilingualism Matters, which by its name gives you the clue that you do think bilingualism does matter. But as you said, you're an Italian living in the UK, you're the parent of bilingual children, so you've got both a personal and an academic perspective on particularly the question of children and their language development. I think it used to be quite common in the UK for parents to think they shouldn't let their children be exposed to two languages at once in case it could confuse them. Could it?
That's a very common perception, but the facts are that there is no evidence of confusion. And in fact, there is plenty of evidence that even very young infants can distinguish between the two languages, initially on the basis of their rhythm, and then, you know, on the basis of vocabulary and grammar.
But isn't there a danger that bilingual or multilingual children might mix up their languages when they're very little, if they start hearing them when they're very young?
Well, it depends on what you mean by mixing up. So language mixing happens for a reason. It happens, for example, because the right word or the word that expresses the meaning that a child wants to say happens to be in the other language. And so if the child is talking to another bilingual, they can borrow from the other language. That's mixing in a strict sense, but it's not mixing as a result of confusion.
Mixing of grammar and things like that.
Mixing of grammar, that is also something that people should know, that two languages in contact to some extent inevitably affect each other. And this is an issue that arises with minority languages, particularly minority languages that are not valued. They are regarded as, you know, old-fashioned, you know, nobody cares about them. And people worry that they're affecting the main language negatively. Now, a certain amount of influence of one language or another is absolutely normal. That's one of the ways languages change. You know, sometimes languages get into contact with one another and they change because they reciprocally affect each other.
What's your advice to parents who want to teach their children to speak their two native languages? How should they go about it? Briefly.
First of all, I wouldn't use the word teach. They don't need language lessons. Children need to hear both languages in sufficient amounts, in situations that are engaging, in situations that motivate them to use them. And so parents have to create an environment in which both languages are heard, which is sometimes quite difficult, but there is no single magic method that ensures that a child grows up bilingual, because what works for my family may not work for your family. Families are all different. And so one parent, one language is not the only method, although many parents think that this is the method. Speaking only the minority language at home and leaving the majority language outside the home, that's another very common method. And if I can add, the attitudes are positive. Because if a child realizes that one of the languages is regarded as useless or stupid, they're obviously not motivated to use it.
We've been talking so far about Indo-European languages, common languages in Europe, English, mm-hmm. Italian, Spanish. Your part, Antonella, aren't you, of a pilot project to teach Mandarin in Scotland, isn't that right?
Yes, indeed.
Do you find that that causes more problems for kids than teaching them another European language?
We're still in the process of analysing the data from that project, but certainly children seem to enjoy Mandarin tremendously and they didn't seem to have particular difficulty with it. People project their own problems onto children. They think, oh, Mandarin is a difficult language. Well, it can be difficult for you and me, but not necessarily for a young child.
Is there a limit to how many languages your brain can hold maybe this is one, Ellen, you can help us with. Do you get kind of full up after you had a few?
Certainly not. So there's certainly no limit at all. It becomes a point, though, of talent. Some people, everybody's good at something. And does everybody have the capacity to acquire an unlimited number of languages? I would say no. I think this is reserved for people who are motivated, talented, highly gifted language learners. Does everybody have the capacity to acquire a couple of languages? Absolutely.
Well, can I just add, there is evidence that knowing more than one language makes you a better language learner. So if you grow up, for example, with the minority language, you can learn another language, a third language or a fourth language more easily.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about, Antonella, was I was interested to read that the arrival of a second child can upset the language balance in a home where more than one language is spoken, so that sometimes a second or third child is less fully bilingual than the first child. Why is that?
Well, it's true that that often happens, and I think it happens because the firstborn prefers to speak the majority language to the younger sibling. Whether they do that because they are dominant in the majority language, or whether they do that because they start feeling different from the other children, and this is something that often happens when a child starts school, they don't want to feel different, and sometimes being bilingual or multilingual is enough to make them feel different, and so they refuse to speak the minority language. They go home and they want to speak, say, English only. As a result, a younger sibling may hear more input in the majority language and less in the minority language. So I think, you know, older siblings can be gently persuaded to speak the minority language. This is what I did in my family. There are 4 years difference between my children, and when my second son was born, I told my oldest son, well, look, you and I are the only people who can really teach Italian to your brother. Because your dad, you know, yes, he can speak Italian, but not as well as we do. And he took me very seriously, and he spoke Italian for a number of years.
Thank you very much. Now, we've talked about bilingualism as a personal experience and from the perspective of a child's development. But Ellen Bialystok, your work takes us into a slightly different and very exciting area. What's going on in our brains when we use language? You're a distinguished research professor of psychology at York University, Toronto, and you've spent decades looking into the impact that speaking two or more languages can have on the brain. Can you briefly explain to us what it is?
Sure. The key is this. Contrary to what you might think, if you have two languages that you are able to speak with some reasonable fluency, and it doesn't have to be perfect fluency, what happens is that when you're speaking one of them, the other language is active, alive, it's available in your mind. Now, you'd think that instead the brain would have been arranged with a bit of a language switch. So I'm speaking English, I turn off French, I'm speaking French, I turn off German, and so on. But it's not. Instead, what happens is that all of these languages that are all interconnected all pop up at the same time. Now, if we're having this conversation in English, then there's a problem, because for our communication to be effective, I have to make sure I'm only choosing from English, because it'll disrupt the conversation if I choose the others. Monolinguals don't have to worry about that. So how does the bilingual solve this fundamental problem of selecting from the language they need to be using now, when these other languages are begging for attention? What the brain does is this. We have a system, a network of brain neurons and the cognitive system in our brain called the executive function system. Its job is to make choices. Attend to what's important, don't get distracted by the other stuff, and make proper selection of what you need to be looking at right now. So what bilingual minds do, it turns out, is just bring in this system that's already there to help them focus on the language they need to be using so the other one doesn't get in the way. Well, what happens is like anything, if you practice, you will get better. And so you're building muscles on this executive function system, and it gets stronger, more efficient, and more effective. And the final point is that it turns out that this executive function system is the most important cognitive system we have. It's the basis of the most difficult thinking, problem solving, planning, and performing that humans engage in. So bilinguals have built up a resource that turns out to be a very important aspect of all thought.
This is really fascinating, isn't it? Because this is cognitive research which suggests then that people who are bilingual, children, get a cognitive advantage, a kind of mental gym exercise that develops their brain networks and, as Antonella was saying earlier, maybe gives them more flexibility, more adaptability.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's like a specialized training where you don't even realize you are being trained.
Gustavo, do you feel like that? Do you feel that using more than one language has sharpened your brain, given you a gym exercise?
Actually, as I was listening to Ellen, what I thought is, I wonder whatever happened to my executive function system, because it doesn't seem to be working properly or making choices fast enough. I am constantly pulled to a stop when I have to find a word in one language or another.
Ellen?
There's a deep paradox in what I've just said. So bilingualism is a linguistic experience that enhances the executive function system. But the irony is that it has its best effect on nonverbal activities. If anything, bilinguals have a harder time in linguistic tasks. Selecting words, naming pictures, producing speech is more effortful for bilinguals. So the paradox is that this cognitive advantage from a linguistic activity actually leaves a kind of negative impact on language.
Go on, it's not just me,
right?
Okay. No, this is science.
That's very reassuring.
There was one other part of your research I wanted to ask you about, Ellen, which is really fascinating, and because you've been conducting pioneering studies to show that if bilingualism or multilingualism is a lifelong experience, then it can be particularly important in old age, because it seems to play a role in, for a time, staving off the impact of dementia.
Right. We had shown bilingualism having a positive effect on the executive function network, which is housed in the front part of the brain. Dementia, and particularly Alzheimer's disease, is first and primarily a memory disorder, and that's housed in the middle part of the brain. So it was hard to imagine why an experience that helps improve the front part of the brain would have any effect at all on a memory disorder. But we looked at it, and to our utter surprise, actually, even in the very first study we did, we found large, reliable effects in which people who had lived most of their lives as bilingual showed symptoms of dementia 4 to 5 years later than comparable monolinguals.
Do you know what it is? Is it just general flexibility, or is there something more specific and located?
We still have a lot more work to do to figure out what it is. My belief now is that as people's ordinary memory systems are starting to become challenged, they can rely on these more powerful frontal networks to perform tasks and function at what appears to be a normal level.
This is very early research, isn't it? I guess you've got a lot more to do. The question for people like me, I suppose, is does this only work, this staving off of this terrible degeneration that can happen with older people? Does it only work if you're born into a bilingual environment? Or should I now go out and sign up for Arabic classes because it'll help my chances to stave off dementia?
Okay, well, two things in response to that. First, the people in our studies, we tend to use a cutoff of around 20 years old, people who've been bilingual since they were about 20. But the second reaction is somewhat different. We we can think about these effects in terms of what's called cognitive reserve. And this is what you hear about all the time. Join a club, do crossword puzzles, take music lessons, all this stuff that helps keep your brain active. The general story about cognitive reserve is that using your brain in stimulating and effortful activities is good for your brain and keeps your mind alert. So, my advice is this: there is nothing that is harder, more effortful, and more stimulating than learning a language. So I say, go out and learn a language, not because you're going to become bilingual, but because the process of engaging your mind in something so difficult and so holistic is just good for your brain.
I'm wondering how you're reacting to that, Gustavo, because you began the program talking to us about the burden of being bilingual, but what Ellen has been telling us from her research is that that burden can actually bring health benefits, possibly.
An unexpected blessing, because as I grow old, bilingual, I'm in terror of actually forgetting things in two languages and forgetting twice as many things as just a monolingual demented person would forget.
This is so fascinating, this idea that bi- or multilingualism can help reorganize the internal way the brain works, literally reshape the brain. It makes you wonder, can different languages really change the way we think? What do you think, Ellen?
I think there's certain languages give you access to different ways of thinking and feeling. I know languages that have very hierarchical interpersonal lexicons, like Japanese, for example, where there are very clear words depending on status and relationship, also bring about a more hierarchical way of thinking. You can't have certain kinds of arguments with people who don't fulfill those requirements. I think very deeply language affects the way we think and interact and see the world.
Your thoughts, Antonella?
I'd like to say something positive about growing bilingual with non-prestigious languages, because they are not attached to political power, and in fact these languages are dying. So if we take this positive spin on the fact that having more than one language in the brain, that's what matters. So there are areas and regions where children can get this gift very easily because there are minority languages spoken. And so people should regard these as privileges rather than burdens.
Thank you very much, and thanks to all three of you, Antonella Soraci, Ellen Bialystok, and Gustavo Perez-Firmat. From me, Bridget Kendall, and all of us here at the Forum, have a good week. And for some bird song to give you a break from the human voice at the end of our show, this week, in homage to your birthplace, Gustavo, it's the call of parrots from Cuba.
The Forum was presented by Bridget Kendall. The producer was Caroline Dunn.